show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we have some things to talk about, sort of. We're still kind of in that weird little holding pattern here where we've getting down as of now, just hours before we started recording, we've been eliminated to only three teams remaining now in the Major League Baseball playoff race, as the Cleveland Indians are keeping that AL title in the Central Division, and they have gone to the World Series for the first time since 1997, hoping to win for the first time since 1948. So
we thought 85 was a long time.
I know. The much maligned city of Cleveland in terms of sports tragedy has now had quite a pretty solid last 6 months or so, as the Cavaliers won the NBA Finals, and now the Indians, of course, going back to the World Series for the first time in nearly 20 years. So, on the other side, who will they be facing? Well, the Dodgers and Cubs are playing Game 4 tonight. Dodgers lead the Cubs 2-1 and have shut them out in two games in a row, so we'll see how that turns out. We'll talk about that a little bit later. First, introductions, of course. I am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, is the contract man himself, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing this evening?
Sounds like I'm a serial or a
like sounds kind of like
you're a hitman.
Ben Affleck in a new movie.
Ben Affleck. You know what? I'll take it if it means I get a co-star with Anna Kendrick.
There you go.
That would be any day.
Well,
yeah, like that's. I can think of a lot of worse ways to spend a few months. Than
filming on set with Anna Kendrick. Yes. I'd be okay with that.
I'd wait in line for, you know, baked goods. That would be cool too. Strolls in the park. You know,
any of the above.
Any of that stuff.
So, before we get into kind of random thoughts on the remaining playoffs, we can talk about the Royals a little bit. So as we're in that holding pattern here, where waiting for the baseball season to end so free agency can start, and then the winter meetings roll in and hot stove talk and all that stuff, and things will start heating up here in the next couple weeks really quickly. But until that time, what we can do is look towards next year from a purely numbers standpoint. Okay, so recently the biggest Royals news that has come out, I guess you could say, is that Dayton Moore had a press conference, he and Ned Yost, and at the press conference, Dayton Moore said, as per usual, that the payroll will not go up next year, or more specifically, there are no plans to increase the payroll next year.
Politically, now, he said it may regress a little.
Yes, that's exactly that was like, those were the exact terms. That's a good point. Yes,
it's like, okay, yeah, I get it.
All right,
regress a little. All right,
and he said similar words basically every year of the last five, and every year of the last five, the payroll has increased. So there's that. And then recently I heard on the radio, Sam Mellinger was talking about an article he wrote that I haven't had a chance to read yet, but he was discussing that very thing with Dayton Moore and David Glass, apparently. And the way he described it was that David Glass said that, you know, it's up to Dayton Moore to convince David Glass that the money is actually worth spending. So the illusion is there. Illusion, not illusion, but the illusion is there that you could say that, you know, Dayton Moore can come and say, hey, you know, X free agent is really going to make this team better. This is the missing piece. We're going to make a run at this thing, but we need the payroll to be $150 million. And David Glass, if he thinks that the proposal is good, will say yes or maybe no. who knows? But so that's kind of the way it goes here. But as we look towards that, knowing those things, you know, where are they at? So all notions of David Glass being cheap can kind of get thrown out the window, because I believe the Royals had the 18th highest payroll last year, 16th highest.
I'm looking at something on Cott's contract that says that by the end of the year, their 40-man roster payroll was 13th.
13th highest. Yeah. And they are the 29th biggest market in the country. Relative to the baseball teams,
they're
in
quite small in that ranking. Yes.
Yes. So they are severely outperforming in terms of spending their actual market standing. So there's that. So all those cries of 10 years ago, David Glass being too cheap, etc., those can kind of go away now because we've thoroughly dispelled that notion. And then as of today, I am out of it, man. This is the auditors are at work today, and I'm like the point man.
Is that the sequel to the Ben Affleck movie?
The auditors. It's like Alien and Aliens.
Yeah.
You saw the auditor. Now see the auditors. There's a whole team of Ben Afflecks. but no, they're here, so I'm running around helping them out all day. So I'm a little scatterbrained today. So Mike, you took the liberty of putting together some spreadsheet numbers that we were looking at before the show. So kind of give a rundown of what you found and then, you know, kind of your thoughts on these numbers.
Well, I looked mostly at what guys were leaving, really. And you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about in the past, that this 2017 window, a lot of the reason for that window is because this is the final year for a number of players. You got Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, Gerard Dyson. Those guys are finishing up their arbitration years. You've got guys like Wade Davis finishing up his contract. Just so many different guys that, you know, they've been on this team for a while. Lorenzo Cain, it's his final year. Ian Kennedy could opt out. Jason Vargas will be a free agent. So you look at, you know, if this is the last shot at everything, you know, those are the guys that, you know, it's not as active of an offseason probably for this year as it will be next year at this time. But there's still, you know, when you look at some of these players that the Royals had in 2016, you have some decisions to make. You know, you look at Edinson Volquez, and they've got a potential mutual option with him. It would pay him $10 million, or there's a $3 million buyout. You know, at this stage, I'm sure he would probably take his end of that. I don't think the Royals would take their end of that. If they decline, they pay him the $3 million buyout, and then it's up to them to offer him a qualifying offer. Now, if they're not going to take the $10 million mutual option, they're not going to offer him the $17.2 million that will be the qualifying offer amount this year, which I think that went up $500,000 from what we kind of were working with. And it was estimated to be at, and then they announced that, okay, it's $17.2 million. So Volquez, I would not count on him being back. Chris Medlin has a $10 million mutual option. I cannot imagine any scenario in which the Royals would take that side of it. He has expressed that he wants to stay, and I think what you can maybe see is that they potentially buy him out. It's $1 million buyout. Can't get around that. And then turn around and maybe offer him a league minimum deal or maybe a minor league deal, give him an opportunity to work his way back and, you know, minimize their investment. So that's another player that, you know, he didn't give you a lot this year, but he gave you some innings in the second half of 2015 and cleaned up a couple of spots in the postseason. And you know, he contributed. This year he struggled in a lot of his appearances, but it is still a player who, if he can get back to full health, you know, you've seen what he can kind of do as maybe a replacement level kind of guy. So that's another player that I would not count on being back. Luke Hochaver, kind of in a similar spot, except his performance was better than Medlin. He went through and had, you know, pretty good season, up and down in spots, and then at the end of July needed to have thoracic outlet surgery. Should be fine for next year, but at the same time, the Royals hold a mutual option on him as well, and it would pay him $7 million for next season if both parties agreed to it, which I think there's a better chance that that might be the case, just because Hochaver, you know, is comfortable with Kansas City and the Royals are comfortable with him. It seems like it's a good fit with the
Royals.
Seems
like the most likely of all the scenarios.
Yeah. Now, the $7 million, that's still quite a lot for a guy that you're not entirely sure how he's going to respond to, you know, the surgery and recovery and everything. So that may be another one where they buy him out and then just get him on a smaller deal, or maybe the lovely incentive-laden contract that you know, teams may try to do. So those are kind of the key guys, and I haven't brought up Kendrys Morales yet. We've talked plenty of about him with the qualifying offer going up. I can't see him declining it if they were to offer it. And so what I think would have to happen, he just hit 30 homers. He's probably going to decline his part of the mutual option. Put the Royals in a position to decide to either give him that qualifying offer or let him go. And maybe they work something out later for maybe a 2 or 3 year contract and see what they can do. But I think if they offer him the qualifying offer, he would probably take it. I've waffled on that, but I think now he would take that, which puts the Royals in a weird spot because, yes, while Dayton Moore can probably convince David Glass to make a payroll addition for the right player, Kendrys Morales at $17 million on top of the declined the buyout for the declined mutual option, that's a lot of money for a guy who, yes, he hit 30 home runs, but you know, you kind of have to have him playing like an elite guy like David Ortiz. And that's not to discount his contributions, but it's just that if all you do is DH, you really have to be the best to really warrant that kind of money. And so those are the kind of guys that I think you would see leave after this year. And you know, on one hand, the Royals are going to have to pay out the buyouts, but you know, it does free up some of the potential payroll that they might be looking at. You know, a lot of the stuff, mostly it's just going to be arbitration guys that you kind of aren't sure about. You know, you've got Alex Gordon, you know, his contract, you know, Ian Kennedy and what he's going to make. Lorenzo Cain, they worked out his deal last season as well. Mike Moustakas has a deal already set up. Chris Young's under contract. So it's really just a matter of seeing how those, you know, who they tender a contract to in arbitration. For the most part, I would imagine they're going to offer almost everybody. Daniel Nava somehow is still arbitration eligible. Don't think they're going to offer him a contract.
No,
probably not. But you've also got guys like Dylan G. He's arbitration eligible. And if the Royals wanted to retain him, he's also coming off of thoracic outlet surgery. So same thing applies with Hochaver. You know, is that a guy that you want to invest the money in? It probably wouldn't be a whole lot. I mean, he played for $2 million in 2016, so maybe $3.5, $4 million. It's possible that's all you'd really be owing him. So that's another player that you might see go away. Along with that, you know, just not a lot of like free agents this year. Peter Moylan was on a minor league deal. He is a free agent. I'm sure the Royals would be interested in bringing him back. I'm sure he's interested in seeing if he can get 2 or 3 years from another team. Drew Butera is a free agent, and he's 34. I didn't realize he was 34 years old.
Wow, I didn't either.
He does not look it. Annoyingly young looking, 34.
He's one of those guys that. Because there are some people that you like, you see, and you're like, man, feels like he's been around forever, but he's not that old. And so it feels like Butera has been around for a long time, but mm-hmm. he also feels like one of those people that I just feel like he's been around for a long time, but He actually has, 34 years old. So
34, he's, yeah.
It's interesting. Okay.
I would imagine after the year that he had, he could maybe pull some kind of a deal. I mean, he hit like, what, 270 or something in a couple of
homers.
I mean,
as far as backup catchers go, I don't know that it gets much better than a Drew Butera. Like, he's quintessential.
He's back, for, at least for the from, backup for last that season. The Royals would need, yeah. I mean, he can fill in. He's good with most of the pitching staff. I think the Royals would be interested in bringing him back. They do have Tony Cruz available, so he didn't really play a whole lot last year in Kansas City, but he would be somebody who might, you know, they might feel like they can slot him in there. I know that Dave Lesky has brought up the name, at least to us here and there, about like Alex Avila, who's a free agent. And maybe having him be a guy who can maybe catch a few more games and give Salvador Perez a few more days off. But, you know, I mean, we can get into potential additions later just because, you know, there's a lot of process that still needs to happen. But, you know, that could be another route that the Royals might go if they wanted to have someone who could step in and fill in for 40 games or so if they really wanted to take a look at keeping Salvador Perez fresh. Or, you know, they could just continue to do the 145 game kind of stuff that they're doing with him now and have Drew Butera play every other Sunday and things like that. So that's another guy that is going to be out of the door. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to be brought back, but I think there would be mutual interest there. But I could definitely see him trying to test the market, see if he can maybe wrangle some kind of two-year, three-year guaranteed deal and back up someplace else and maybe get more playing time somewhere else. But those are kind of the main guys that are leaving. So it's not really a big turnover kind of year. I mean, you're going to have to replace a starter in Edinson Volquez, but you do get Jason Vargas back. So he finished up in 2016, looked pretty good, should be fully healthy, you know, from now on. You know, at least as far as his elbow is concerned. So he should be the number four guy, at least right now. And then number five, you maybe go out to the market and see, or, you know, maybe there's a trade to be made. But, you know, you're looking at filling out the bullpen, getting some guys who could possibly be in the starting rotation. And then maybe you see if you can add some power and see if there's a, you know, someone for DH if you don't keep Morales, or if you can add a bat to maybe rotate within the rest of the lineup, and kind of go from there. So it's kind of an interesting offseason in that there are small choices to make, but there's also, you know, that you've got to look towards, hey, in 2017, most of these guys won't be here.
And I think the kind of paradox, if you will, that you just mentioned is really going to be interesting, because they do need to look to be adding more power. But then at the same time, you know, you hit it right in the head with your assessment of the Morales situation. So, you know, how they're going to handle that is going to be really interesting, because, you know, do you say no to Kendrys Morales and then go out and, you know, I mean, we saw Billy Butler sign a free agent contract for three. He's on the market, I think. Did somebody pick him up?
Yankees signed him.
Oh, that's
after
right.
After he
that's
got
right.
released.
Forgot so. About that. But, you know, I mean, he signed a $30 million contract no more than 2 years ago. And so, you know, someone of that caliber, and I think most people would say Kendrys Morales is better than Billy Butler, especially now.
Especially now.
So, you know, I mean, if you're going to go and get somebody of Kendrys Morales's, or, you know, roughly the same caliber, you're still going to be paying about $10 million. So then if you don't pay Morales, you know, I mean, maybe he wouldn't sign for that, but that's just, you know, I don't know that I have an opinion one way or another or have anybody in mind that they should sign, but that's going to be interesting, because that's going to be kind of a weird, similar to Volquez, really. They're going to let him go. I don't see him coming back, but then they're going to end up probably paying a similar amount for about a similar pitcher. So that'll be kind of interesting to see how that situation works out to try and fill that hole that he's gonna leave.
Yeah, and the difference with those two is, you know, Volquez really was not good this year.
Right,
Morales,
he's a little bit easier to.
Yeah, you can definitely justify letting him go, and, you know, you thank him for 2015. He was great in 2015,
absolutely,
regular season and postseason. But in 2016, it never got going for him. Morales is a different story because, I mean, what did he hit 2 years ago? 25 homers and drove in 100 runs, 22. And then this year, 30 homers and approached 100. So it would look really, really strange for the Royals to say they need power and let this guy who just hit 30 home runs walk. But at the same time, the economics of it, I don't think you can justify $17 million for Kendrys Morales. If you say that, even if you say that a win, like a win above replacement, like best case, let's say it's $9 million is the value of it. And I don't know what it's, you know, a couple of years ago, people would estimate it at $6 million per war. So if you're looking at $18 million, he would have to be then, a three war player if it's at a $6 million per win. If it's $9 million, which I think is probably really high still, you know, that hasn't inflated to that point yet, it's still, he's got to be a two win player. And at DH, where there, you know, he's not going to have much base running contribution, which is part of the war calculation. He's not going to have defensive value. He's got to excel and be basically the best DH in baseball to justify that amount. And it's just tough to do that. It's, you know, that the amount of his option is $11 million if both sides exercise it. But I just can't see how he would do that. The difference would be he has to know that the Royals won't make him the qualifying offer because he knows that they know that he'll take it. And so if he declines his side of the mutual option, they don't offer him that, the qualifying offer. Now he has free agency and there is no draft pick attached to him. So a team that signs him, unlike a couple of years ago, they don't have to worry about losing that draft pick and that draft pool money for signing him. And so that's what held him out in 2014, was that, you know, nobody wanted to sign, you know, it's not that he didn't have teams that wanted his services. It was that they didn't want to pay him the salary plus lose a draft pick. And so he floundered and ended up signing with the Twins in June and got traded to the Mariners and then hit free agency. The Royals took a chance and it paid off, but now it's in the same kind of situation. And I think he would take the qualifying offer. I think in the past, I wasn't sure if he would take it, but I think he would take it. And so I think now the Royals would not offer it.
Yeah, it's just such a funny situation to be in when you say, like, hey, we need so much power. And then the first guy to hit 30 home runs in almost 20 years for the team, you're just going to let him go.
Yeah.
So
it does look weird and it feels weird, but
It's the dumbest smart move they could make to let Morales walk.
Yeah.
Dumb in the sense that obviously they're giving away power, not necessarily giving it away, because, you know, I mean, he's not like, it's an option. He's not under contract necessarily, by the conventional means. But, dumb because they're letting him walk, but then smart because financially speaking, Morales is going to be a year older. You know, he did struggle a lot this year. It's the smart move to just let him go. But at the same time, it's like, it's just such a hard, but
yeah,
that'll be, you know, we've mentioned it before, but that'll be kind of a big piece of how this offseason goes. One of the more fun things to track.
Yeah. It's going to be the one thing that gets a lot of comments on Facebook, probably, when the Royals announce declining either, you know, the option and not making the offer, because
yeah, and there's going to be plenty of people that are just waiting for Morales to sign on somewhere, and then the first home run of the season he hits, even if he goes 0 for his first 30 and then hits the home run, you know, then it'll just be, oh my god, I can't believe the Royals let him go,
right?
And
exactly,
all this stuff. It's like,
that's,
you know,
that's how it goes. That's
fandom in the 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, that'll be interesting. But again, if they think that they can find that power somewhere else for cheaper or younger, or if they feel like they want to rotate other guys at DH and try to go with the homegrown group, you know, that's an option that they could try. So, you know, it's an interesting question. It's going to be interesting to see how they approach it, but I'm pretty sure that it's going to end up with Morales at least being back on the market. Now, maybe he's comfortable in Kansas City and will re-sign for a similar deal to what he signed in the first place. But I can't imagine that the Royals are willing to take the chance that they're going to have to pay him $17 million, even if you know they feel like he might decline it and they could get that draft pick compensation. It's too much
of a risk. Like, with that kind of money and as important of a season as it is, you know, it's a smarter play if you want Morales back in any way to buy out the option and then try and turn him around and sign him to like a $10 million deal or something for 1 year, maybe 2 years or something like that. Then it is, you know, the risk of losing him in that scenario is more palpable to the team, I would imagine, than the risk of him, as you mentioned, taking that qualifying offer, which I'm certain he would do before the fax is even sent. He would crawl yeah. through the fax machine and sign it on the way.
He would just fax them the completed and signed
one. He would fax them the signature just paste it on there, you know, in case you were looking for something like that. But so that's kind of, you know.
The other part of that is the timing of it. I mean, they have to resolve those things. You know, they have to decide to issue it within.
Too.
Yeah, you have to decide if you want to offer it within 5 days of the World Series. And there's, you know, basically, if he accepted it, if they offered it and he accepted it, that would be $17 million out of their budget that they can use this offseason. So right away, you're starting with that kind of anchor on what you can do. And, you know, I don't know what they might go for as far, you know, even if you can justify advancing the payroll and you know, allowing it to go higher. If you're David Glass, there's a point where they're not going to be like a $165 million payroll team. You know, if they go up, it might be, you know, $10 million higher than this year or something like that. You know, they might set up some kind of contract extension with a guy like Danny Duffy or Kelvin Herrera that pays them below market for 2017. And then backloads the rest of whatever extension years they have, or, you know, adds a buyout at the end that's pretty hefty or something that allows them to take the burden off of this year where they would be arbitration eligible and shifts that kind of impact to later on in 2018, 2019, 2020, where you're probably playing with a lot more young team control, pre-arbitration or early arbitration kind of guys. Similar to like what you saw in 2011, 2012, and kind of getting into 2013, where they, you know, were able to have Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas making pretty small amounts, but still being key contributors to the big league team. So that's probably the main way that they can get some kind of payroll relief and leave themselves some openings to go out and sign, you know, the two or three key contributors they feel like they probably want to go out and get.
The impact of next year, I don't know if it can be quite understated, because it's just like there's so many year. It's a huge year. I mean, how many ways can this go here? Because you've got, okay, repeat of 2015 and this administration, the Dayton Moore era, Ned Yost, basically all the players go down in history, you know, greatest Royals run ever. Everyone here is beloved. Eric Hosmer is, you know, maybe the biggest Kansas City hero since George Brett, whether he leaves or not. And, you know, whatever they do the next 5 years probably doesn't really matter, to be quite honest. You know, the fans will come and they'll be happy. You know, then there's the repeat of this past season where they kind of hang on and it's just like, man, was this a waste? What was the situation? This was, kind of a weird season. And then the other alternative is your, not quite 2013, but like your 2012, you just got off to a bad start. you're, you know, 10 games below 500 at the All-Star break, 15 games out of first place, whatever the case may be. And then it's like, you know, maybe that's too much for the scenario I'm trying to describe here, because I think then it would be obvious they just sell everyone they could immediately, because there's no way they're getting back into it. But let's say you're, you know, closer to this season or 2013. So we will use those, you know, where you're maybe you're five games under 500, maybe seven, eight games back. You know, it's like, how do you gauge? It's a little bit different when you know this year with the injuries of 2016, knowing everyone was coming back for 2017, it was a little bit easier to say, okay, let's hold on here because we can still make a run this year. And if not, we're still intact for next year. But if the same thing happens again next year, you're like, okay, we run the risk of finishing out and getting nothing from this season. And then, you know, letting Hosmer et al. Just walk and we get nothing for him. You know, I mean, I'm sure they're going to give qualifying offers and such, but if that's even still a thing,
yeah, whatever
the collective bargaining agreement is going to be renegotiated before that happens. So who knows if those are still things, because I know the players union is not very happy about the current state of the qualifying offer, and they shouldn't be. But it's kind of the only thing that gives a little leverage to organizations in that scenario for baseball. So, if the Royals don't jump out like they did in, you know, even the last couple of years, you know, you say, you know, they were 12-6 to start out the season this year, and, you know, 15-7 the year before. So, I mean, they need to start like that, and they need to continue it. You know, I mean, by the All-Star break, they got to be like 10 games above 500. Because if they're just like 500, I mean, that's going to be a really tough spot for them. And, you know, do you stand pat thinking you can get better second half team and all that? Do you go for it, make some trades, try and really make a run at the second half? Or do you sell off and say, hey, it was a good run, let's build for the future? So, I mean, this is going to be...
The first 3 months of 2017 are going to be very interesting, because they can shift so much of how this franchise goes. I mean, I think at this stage, the only guys that we can kind of expect the most likely players to sign some kind of an extension are probably Duffy, Herrera. I think there's good odds there. I don't think the Royals are all that interested in an extension with Kane. Last off season, that was an option that he kind of expressed to them, and then they only basically set up, you know, the 2-year contract to get through what their team control was. I just don't think that they... I think it's mostly that they don't want to have two outfielders in their, you know, early to mid-30s with Alex Gordon out there as well, especially when you see what happens. You know, Kane, for the most part, does run into these injuries, and the hamstring injury that, you know, cost him a month, had the wrist injury that he's still recovering from now, even a couple of weeks after the season has ended. So I don't think that they see him as someone that they're looking to retain after 2017. Moustakas, they probably would like to keep. You know, the key thing of that is that Chesler Cuthbert is out of options. So what do you do with him? You know, is that...
That's a good point.
What you do, you know, they've got him in instructional leagues trying to work on second base again / some more, but, you know, it's... I just don't think that's going to happen. I mean, they've got guys like Whit Merrifield and Raul Mondesi and Christian Colon who are actual second basemen who can actually play the position. You know, it's to where I don't think they can shoehorn Cuthbert into that. His defense would have to improve so much for that position. So I don't know. I don't think that's going to be a thing that happens. So where does that leave him with Moustakas? And then, you know, Hosmer is kind of the other guy that I know that there was some chatter, you know, earlier this season about, oh, well, maybe he's got this offer in mind and they're close and within a couple weeks. But last year, I don't think Scott Boras is going to allow his all-star MVP, highly marketable, coming off career high in home runs, you know, Eric Hosmer, sign an extension with the team.
That's exactly what you would say is Scott Boras' style.
Yeah, peak year, you know, they're going to cash in. Eric Hosmer's not going to... It's Eric Hosmer's last season as a Royal. I mean, that's the reality of it. Unless something really crazy happens, which I just don't see happening. So you go up and down the line, and it's just a lot of unique kind of situations where you've got all these guys leaving at once. And so, yeah, like you said, if they're just treading water halfway through the season, I mean, you almost, I mean, the worst place they could be is right around 500 or game over 500, stuff like that. Because then what do you do? You know, yeah. if you're behind, I mean, if
basically
you're in the same...
a repeat of this past season is kind of the worst place they can be.
Yeah, because your most likely outcome is to finish in the middle of the pack. You have to count on another crazy like August run or 15 of 20 kind of run, which you know, I think at a certain point, you know, at a certain point you roll craps and you're done. It doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't happen. So, you know, if you go through all of that and then don't maximize your return on guys, if you need to trade them, then that's tough. If you keep them and don't make the playoffs, that's tough. It's just, there's going to be a certain point where if they're not in it, they have to weigh, okay, will the prospect return that we can get for these guys outweigh the draft return that we could potentially get? And I think at that point, once you've got prospects in the big leagues, or not in the big leagues, but you know, in the minors, upper minors or whatever, you can kind of get a feeling for how they're going to be, whereas the draft is kind of a crapshoot. I think they would probably look to trade a lot of those guys off and just reload that way. So unless they're 15 games above 500 at the All-Star break, and then you go for it. You know, you just sell out.
Then you sell everything you possibly can. If it's 2015 Redux, and
yeah,
that's where you're sitting and you're number one team in the American League, no one would fault you for just going balls to the wall and making it happen.
Yeah. I mean, you'd end up with some struggles because, like, you know, you'd probably have to, you know, it just depends. If they're playing that well, maybe you don't need that many pieces, but, you know, you're trading away your top five prospects, maybe. To add two pieces or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but by the end of the year, you're going to have, you know, Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer and maybe Gerard Dyson and maybe Danny Duffy and maybe, you know, maybe three or four guys. Well, probably not Dyson. They probably wouldn't give him any kind of qualifying offer. But you've got all those other guys who, you know, Hosmer and Moustakas, you definitely know that they're going to go somewhere for a multi-year contract. So you're going to get draft picks for those guys. Duffy would probably be the same. So, I mean, that's three. I mean, so much can change that it's probably not even productive to go over this stuff. But, you know, that's kind of the question that they have in front of them. Do they, and still so many hypotheticals, you know, but that's what they have to kind of weigh is what kind of return can we get for these guys once they're gone, you know, even if it's by a trade or it's by going to free agency. You know, hopefully it's free agency with two rings for all of those guys and they can go
right.
Cash in and make a lot of money and play somewhere else. Or maybe Kansas City. I don't know. Moustakas,
who knows?
Could maybe be open to something like that. But
that's another question. Okay, so if you... let's say absolute best case scenario, that's what happens, right? Royals just win it all again. Three World Series, two World Series championships, three AL titles. If you're the Royals, you're David Glass, Dayton Moore, do you pull a Marlins and you say, hey, thanks and good luck? You know, because the Marlins after 97 and 2003 just completely dismantled their entire team mm-hmm. twice. So do you do that? Or then do you come back and say, you know what? Like, let's just keep it rolling. Let's sign Hosmer to a $150 million contract. Let's sign Duffy to a $100 million contract. Let's sign Moose to, you know, I mean, let's do this. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. obviously, the Royals can probably raise like $150 million, but at some point, there's definitely an economic ceiling, a reality that's going to set in. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, do they push it as far as that can possibly go to try and keep as much of this alive as they can? You know, I mean, I feel like Ewan Kaufman kind of did something similar to that, you know, yeah. near the
in the late 80s, early 90s. Yes.
Yeah, definitely. So not nearly as much of an outlay in terms of cash and commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, still, like, I think there was some effort there.
Heavily invested. I mean, Mark Davis had the biggest contract in baseball for a brief moment. And as painful as that is, even so, it was like, I don't even remember what it was. It was like $20 million for 4 years or something. I don't remember what that deal was.
Oh, the good old days.
I have blocked that year as much as I can because it was awful. But they went out. It's, you know, 89, they finished second. In 1990, they went out, signed the reigning National League Cy Young Award winner. They were the only team to start a season with both of the reigning Cy Young Award winners from each league in 1990.
Boom.
Brett Zabrakan had won it in 89. It got them nowhere. they had a terrible season. But, yeah, Storm Davis, they signed him, even though I think he got like six runs in run support in all of his starts playing for Oakland in 89. Go figure, it didn't translate to Kansas City.
Weird.
To pre-fences moved in Kansas City. Yeah. But, I mean, they did that. They invested. They tried to really give it a push. And later in before 93, Ewing Kauffman went out and gave a huge pitch to David Cohen and brought him in and gave them another shot at it. And by 94, you know, they were, you know, potentially on the road for a playoff spot. And then the players went on strike and went downhill from there. Went downhill badly.
Downhill really, really fast from there. And those things kept.
But if the Royals win two World Series in 3 years, you can kind of live in that kind of baseball apocalypse for a couple of years, and maybe that will keep you warm. But yeah, but back then, no, there was no, it was not a happy, fandom back in '95 until.
No, and I mean, relatively speaking, you know, that would kind of coincide, like, if you gave a lot of contracts after 2017, then they just kind of petered out, you know. Then by the time you got to 2020, it'd be roughly the same time frame, you know, when things would really start probably going downhill. And then by 2022 or so, you know, and Hosmer's still making $20 million a year, and he's, let's see, how old he'd be by then, 60, be 32. So it wouldn't be outlandish if he was still playing well. So he might not, he might not have a big downfall or anything, but you get what I'm trying to say here. It'd be a very similar scenario if they were to find themselves in that situation again.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think you'd have fewer just overall busts, but still it's, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it kind of works out. Baseball's a kind of weirdly different place, and, you know, maybe that, you know, the Royals are better at building things up. One thing the Royals weren't doing in the 90s, in the mid 90s, was they were not scouting Latin America. They weren't doing much at all there. So,
not
granted, there's talk of an international draft. I haven't really read up on it, so I can't really speak intelligently on it. But it seems like
I've heard most are against it. I know that much.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it's a good thing to grow the game or not, because.
Well, it's interesting because. Sorry, but I do know that there was, just in some of the research I did back when I was like writing all the draft stuff, you know, for you at Kings Kauffman, like, it's an interesting dynamic there, because a lot of people, I don't know if they'll come right out and say it like this, but from front office standpoints for a lot of different teams, I think they feel this is the one area where they can truly have an advantage over another team. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, you can see something and want to do something with, like, a high school player, you know, but everybody knows about these high school players. You know, the top 10, 15 guys, there's pretty well a consensus usually on who the top guys are within any given year. And there's only so much you can really say, like, oh, hey, nobody notices this, but we do, type of thing. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to, I mean, the Royals, you know, finding Salvador Perez, finding, you know, guys like Kelvin Herrera, like a lot of those guys that they can, you can literally find people that other teams cannot find, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if you put it into a draft, then it's a little bit more of a different scenario because they've got to declare for a draft and then everybody knows who they are and you can go do your research. And maybe that kind of levels the playing field a little bit, but at the same time, it also takes away a competitive advantage. So I think that's a really interesting dynamic that it doesn't get a lot of press because it's not really a sexy topic, but it's, to me, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the Royals for so long didn't do that and were at a disadvantage. And then once they started to, well, now they find this all-star and they find this number three starter and they find this potential closer. And, you know, maybe Raul Mondesi turns into something. And the thing is, like, the Royals can know that, like, a couple years ago, Kyle Schwarber hammered the crap out of college pitching, just awesome hitter. You know, a lot of teams loved him. A lot of teams had no shot at him because he wasn't going to get to them in the draft. They could be completely willing to pay whatever he wants, but if you're picking 24th and he goes, I think it was like 6th or 8th or whatever that year, you got no shot at him. But if you like Raul Mondesi and you go down there and he's playing by your academy and you have a relationship with him, well, now you can sign him when he's, you know, 16 years old and eligible to sign that contract, and now your work, your effort, and your, you know, ingenuity pays off. And you know, I think an international draft kind of takes away from that because, yeah, you might still have to put in the effort to scout him, but whoever the number one pick is, you know, that team can pick whoever they want, who they know they can sign, and the other teams are just out of luck. It doesn't matter if that's, you know, if that kid in the Dominican's been a Yankees fan his whole life and wants to sign with the Yankees, but the Angels have the first pick, doesn't matter. You know, he's, you know,
does
he's,
not matter.
It's you take what we offer you, or, you know, whatever. You know, I'll see ya.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I don't know if that's. I think I saw somebody retweet something with a comment of like, "This is the best way to grow soccer in Latin America." Because it's like, okay, you know, it drives down the bonuses. I mean, that's a big reason why they don't want the, you know, the draft is how it is, why they have these caps, because, you know, you want to, the owners want to limit their spending as much as they can.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I hadn't really thought about it from that angle, wherein you look at the idea that, you know, drafting, you know, obviously you end up with the player, but what it really is you're drafting the rights to this person for a certain period of time when they play baseball. It's like a, it's almost like a trademark. You know, you have the right to use X thing in this circumstance for a certain period of years. And so it's really, I hadn't really thought about that angle too, where you, you know, if you're from Latin America and you don't like the fit with, you know, the Red Sox, then you can go sign with somebody else, or you can just keep developing your skills. But if you're, if there's a draft all of a sudden and the Red Sox draft you, just like you mentioned, then it's like, well, you know, there's nothing I can do. And then it's like, you know, from some of these people, you know, and some of the poorer countries, you know, is college really an option? Like, can they come to America if it's not for baseball? You know, I mean, there's sometimes it's difficult for players in these types of situations. So that's an interesting angle that I hadn't really thought of.
It's there's a, my grandma's in a assisted living, and there's a sign on the wall by their kitchen, and it's it says today's menu, take it or leave it. And that's pretty much what it comes down to in that situation. It's, you know, hey, you wanna leave the Dominican? Well, you can basically play for this team, or you don't play. You know, if you want to get paid, this is what you can agree to. And, you know, on one hand, yeah, okay, that does help ownership, but on the other hand, it doesn't really, you know, put that player in the best position they can be, and it doesn't really reward the team that puts in the effort to, you know, learn this player and find out, you know, what they want and kind of make it work. So, you know, I don't know. I guess those are my first thoughts of an international draft, and we'll see if it gets implemented or not. I definitely think it does kind of take some of the incentive out for some teams who have put in that effort and that hustle to actually build up a program like the Royals have done over the last few years, where they have one of the better Latin scouting groups in baseball. So it's, you know, if that evens it out with them and some other team that doesn't do that much, that's not as advantageous. And especially for a small market team, you know, you really have to get those guys to hit so that, you know, you can actually get that talent into your system, get it early, develop it, and then have it debut at the age of 20 and or you know what, 19 or 20 in the World Series like Raul Mondesi.
Yes.
It's very vital.
Yeah, so I think that's enough future talk for this show. We'll have plenty of time in the offseason to talk about any further issues, but I guess a parting discussion we can kind of talk about. I mentioned at the top of the show, the current baseball playoffs. We've got congratulations to the American League champion Cleveland Indians, as I said, keeping it in the Central Division, which is, I don't know. Okay, let's have an aside.
Okay.
Which never happens, but so you get some people in these types of scenarios, American League pride, American League Central Division pride, blah, 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 et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is that a thing for you? Is that something that you're like, you know, yeah, American League Central? Like, that's a thing for you?
Not really.
I'm not saying it is, but I'm curious if it is.
I mean, I always root, even before it counted, I would always root for the American League in the All-Star game. I would generally root for the AL team in the World Series most of the time, unless it was Oakland.
Okay.
But it's not kind of, you know, I would liken it most to maybe like conferences. It's like if Iowa State went to the Final Four in basketball, I wouldn't be like, yeah, Big 12. Because Iowa State's a bad example. sorry, Iowa State fans, but I don't like Iowa State. But, you know, let's say Baylor or something, you know. I wouldn't be like, oh, yeah, I'm for Baylor because they're Big 12. It's like, you know, I'm still going to pick what team I like. So divisionally, I really wouldn't say that it's anything like that. If nothing else, I'd kind of like those teams to not do well because the Royals might do better the next year. But, right. I mean, the way that Francona's managed has kind of grown on me to make me like their style a bit. But mm-hmm. if it's like Cubs-Indians, I'm rooting for the Cubs because I like the Cubs. If it's Dodgers, I, you know, maybe I'll have a decision, but you know, it's not like a hardcore thing. I think I usually root for the AL because I've always been more familiar with it being a Royals fan.
Yeah. You know, I'm definitely kind of in that same boat. You know, I've always thought that the, you know, root for your conference thing, whatever, is really just like why
right.
type of thing. I mean, you know, like you spend all year, you know, let's say you and I are Kansas fans, so let's say it's Kansas State or Missouri that makes the Final Four, right? I mean, we're in a right
anyway,
but you know, you spend all year, all season rooting against these teams,
all off-season, hating really, I mean.
them, yeah, hating them, going back and forth with the fans, and now I'm just going to be like, hey, yay, I'm rooting for you. It's like, no, that's not how sports fandom works, at least not for me. So, you know,
it'd be like Yankees fans rooting for the Red Sox. It just, yeah, I don't
exactly
think
yeah
works.
Just because like, hey, American League East, you know, no.
Yeah, I don't
now
think
you know the Indians, I think, might be the team in the Central I have the least problem with of the teams in the Central.
Yeah,
like
that's
the
fair.
Fans, I absolutely abhor. They're awful. Their fans are awful. And, you know, whatever. I'm just not a twin. There's probably some residual hatred for their dominance of the division recently.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me dislike them a lot. And then, you know, the White Sox are just the White Sox. And then the last year, they just seem like a poorly run organization. It's hard for me to have respect for organizations that are just like seemingly so poorly run. Because, I mean,
They did replace Robin Ventura, though. So they got one thing right, despite everybody else.
Assuming the
protests.
Replacement is correct.
You know, it's hard to hard to go worse than Robin Ventura.
That's very true. But
Tony Muser is about
Tony Muser. Yeah, the only way you get worse. The Royals have a few candidates.
Trey Hillman.
Trey Hillman. Oh, Jesus. Those days are behind us, Mike.
They are.
They're behind us forever now.
That's true.
But see, I'm not. I mean, I definitely wanted Cleveland over Toronto. That's 100%.
Oh, easily. Yeah, easily. Especially when Bautista started whining about things. It's like that makes it even better. He gives up a double, then whines about the umpires. And then today was like, oh, we're not afraid of this rookie who is going to make a spot start, who almost no hit him for like five innings and ended up beating him. So like no love lost for Toronto. And I think nobody else likes Toronto except Toronto.
No, that's 100% true. Yeah. That is factual. Nobody likes Toronto as much as Toronto, and just nobody playing likes Toronto except for Toronto.
Right.
So, but Toronto, you know, we both shifting to the National League to see who will face Cleveland in the World Series. Both of us imagined that the Nationals were going to beat the Dodgers. That didn't happen, and now the Dodgers have. I don't know if commanding is the right word for it at 2-1, 2 games to 1, but a solid lead. Mm-hmm. 2 games to 1 in a best of 7 series. You know, I think it's like a 60% win rate for the series or something like that. So that's, you know, they're in a good position right now, especially when you consider the fact they've shut out the Cubs 2 games in a row. Right. And I heard a stat on the radio this morning that, on my way home actually, that no team that has been shut out in 2 consecutive games in a series has gone on to win the World Series. So for whatever that's worth. But the Cubs are a very good team, very good offense. So if there are teams or, you know, people that could kind of change history in that regard, the Cubs are most decidedly a very good candidate to do it. Whether they do or not remains to be seen. We'll have a better idea in a few hours once this game 4 is over with. And we'll know, you know, if it's going to be, if they're going to be in desperation mode down 3-1, or if they're going to be sitting pretty decent at 2. But with, since we both thought the Nationals were going to win, Nationals didn't, Dodgers are in, you want the, in that assumption there?
I still want the Cubs. Yeah. I mean, they're not hitting though. That's one thing.
No, like they are not.
You know, I think generally you're going to see, you know, you have more strategic bullpen management, better, like more matchups based pitching decisions. More guys are available for more innings in shorter series. So, you know, I think you can really match things up. They, you know, they just haven't hit. And, you know, it's surprise. I mean, the first game they did okay. And they got 8 runs, 4 of those on 1 swing. You know, really since then though, they've, you know, Rich Hill dominated them, Kershaw dominated them, which is easy. I mean, it's easy for that to happen because those are both great pitchers. They haven't done anything through 2 innings tonight, though they did threaten. But they're just, you know, shut out twice for a team that scored so many runs in the regular season. It's a bad time to go cold, and I guess we'll see if they can just turn it up, you know, just on a switch. But if they don't, I mean, if they go to 3-1, it's pretty tough for them to make that comeback just because
I remember how comfortable
in a row.
Yeah. I mean, I remember how comfortable I felt last year when, you know, as good as the Blue Jays were, the Royals being up 3-1 against them last year, you know,
sure
still felt really
comfortable.
I mean,
it's the Blue Jays.
Obviously, you know what, like, regardless, in context, as comfortable as you can feel in a 7-game series, which the baseline level of comfort in a 7-game series is incredibly low. But, you know, I felt more comfortable with a 3-game lead than in any other scenario, for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, when they lost
for whatever
game 5, it wasn't a panic. It was still okay.
We've still got two games in Kansas City. We've still got a 3-2 lead. We're still in a good position.
Yeah. So,
and that's the thing, because when you're up 3-1, if you lose, it's like, okay, we still have the series lead and we still have two games left to win one. Whereas the other team is like, if you're down 3-1, there's no looking back. You got to win every game. That's a tough spot to be in.
Yep. And especially you have to throw literally everything when you have the chance to do it. If you get, you know, John Lester goes out and struggles, well, you got to find within three innings if you need to take him out or not, which changes if you're pitching with the lead or pitching tied in the series, because then, you know, you can maybe let him grind it out and not, you know, wreck your bullpen and not kind of play, you know, Russian roulette with your relievers and just hope that the next guy can actually pitch for you. So it changes a lot of things in that dynamic if you're especially down 3-1, but even 3-2 and, you know, struggling like that. So I don't know. The Cubs just got a nice call. So at this point, it's like 8 o'clock when we're recording. And second inning just ended. So that's kind of where we are for the context of anybody listening in that game. So we'll see if the next seven innings, if their bats wake up or if they don't. If they don't, I mean, they're a great defensive team and they have good pitching, but it's not going to be enough to overcome, you know, if they lose this game. You know, you still have to score the runs. And they, other than the first game in the series, they haven't really come close. So it's kind of weird to see it because, again, the Cubs, you know, all they did for the first 2 months of the season was hit homers and drive in runs. But now they can't. So October, go figure.
All right, October baseball. It's the – given what we make these baseball players go through and – all that stuff, like it's just kind of unfair, to be honest. The baseball playoffs. I've never really liked baseball playoffs, but you know this.
Yeah, so it's not ideal to go with playing every day for 6 months, and then if you have one bad week, that's your season. It's tough. It's like Billy Bean. His stuff doesn't work in the playoffs. You know,
yep.
It's just there's variance, and that, you know, I think the variance probably led to the Royals making a World Series and probably winning a World Series. But
no, that's absolutely especially in 2014.
Oh yeah,
that was a huge part of the Royals, yeah. And their success. But
I'm not giving it back though. So
certainly not.
They can come and take it if they want to try, but it's not going to happen.
Good luck.
Tell the Indians it's just variance. They don't care.
Yeah,
they're no one in cares. It. Oh, you can't use Andrew Miller like that in the regular season. So what? Who cares?
Okay.
Using him now. It counts.
Tell
now.
Me at which point I'm supposed to care.
Right. I'll tell you as I'm dumping this beer on my friends.
As we're hoisting this trophy above your fans, we'll tell you exactly about all that. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to watch it kind of go to work, especially when you start off with the Buck Showalter decision with Zach Britton and then turn around and see that Andrew Miller's basically throwing like half the innings for the Indians.
Yeah, and it's not like the Indians have this, like, I mean, they've got a really good bullpen, but it's not like there's some great luxury that they've had simply because, you know, in, was it game three that Trevor Bauer or game four?
Yeah, it was
game four that Trevor Bauer, sliced his finger on a drone that he was preparing before the game. And so he tried to go out there and pitch, but he's getting blood all over the place. His finger is cut open. He's got blood on the baseball and all this stuff. So he can't, there's nothing, he can't pitch. So he only got two outs. So they have to go essentially an entire game without their entire bullpen. So, you know, that really puts a hamper on it. And they've still just kind of, whatever, we're going to win the moment. And that's, you know, that's kind of the Royals mentality from the last couple of years, and it's paying off for the Indians as well.
Yeah, so far. And Kenley Jansen's kind of been used the same way. And the weirdest thing was you got Clayton Kershaw getting a save in the National Series. It's like, all right, you know, managers get to that point where it's like, we're just going to go do it. Whatever you got to do to win the game, you know, there's in some cases literally no tomorrow for it. So, you know, whatever the case may be. And in the case of the Dodgers, Jansen is a free agent. So it's like, you know, if they use him for two plus innings every game that they need him, you know, they're putting 10-ish more innings on his arm for a guy that they're not going to have next year. So, I mean, not that it's like okay if they feel like, you know, if you feel like that's pitcher abuse, but, you know, it's not like he's telling him no.
Right. Yeah. And
he's going out there too. I mean, it's like he's willing to go probably more. Honestly, he's probably like, yeah, I'll pitch four for you if you need me to. But
yeah. And that's the thing I was going to say. Every single one of these players, too, is not against it at all. They're going to definitely take it.
Yeah. If they're not the guy saying, give me that ball in that spot, then they're maybe not the guy you want on their team, which, you know, they're definitely up for it. One last observation, I think. Julio Urias, I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly. His jersey number is 7. That's interesting. You never see pitchers with you. It's rare.
That's true.
Very rare, but they're very rarely single digits. Chris Archer has a single digit number. I think there may be one other pitcher, but I can't think of him off the top of my head. It's very strange. It does not look normal.
That's a good point
to me.
That is, that is interesting.
Maybe it's a trend, kind of like in football that you never saw wide receivers with numbers in the teens,
right?
Or 10, and now you see it. Like half the receivers are like that now. Usually they've been in the 80s, but
yeah. Well, they changed the rules. It used to be you had to be in the 80s.
Oh, I didn't know there was a rule. Why is there a rule? That's dumb.
There's a rule for all the player numbers, and so it used to be back in the like 10 years ago that you could be a, like, you'd see tight ends in occasionally with like a number in the 40s, because if you had all your numbers, your 80s numbers taken up, yeah, then you could go into the 40s, and then,
but you can use them as a tight end.
And actually Keyshawn Johnson, who was number 19, he literally paid a fine every game of his NFL career because he wore that number rules. And then they changed it a few years ago. So players, wide receivers can now wear numbers 10 through 19 as well.
That's really weird.
You know, they're trying to get the wide receivers. A lot of them have been trying to get it to allow the single digits. So there you go. That's your little bit of football knowledge on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Gotta stick it in every once. Oh, that was bad. Gotta. Okay. I think we'll leave.
Probably time to go.
That'll be time to go on that one. So thank you all so much for listening. We'll still be back again. We're kind of, apologies for not a ton of Royal news. There's nothing we can do about it. We're just here giving you the best content that we can, talking about as much as we can about Royals and baseball. So things will start picking up here. The World Series, we'll have that to talk about. And then after that, it'll be, you know, the free agency winter meetings, hot stove. It'll start rolling fast. So be excited for that. And that's, we'll be here with stuff. Absolutely. We'll be here the whole time. You're ready to talk about all of it. So stick with us throughout the rest of the off season. And then what's sure to be an exciting 2017 when we get there. But until then, thank you guys so much for listening. Couldn't do it without you. Thanks to our sponsors, of course, Kelly's West Port Inn, Baseball Prospectus, and thanks to you, Mike. I don't know if I thank you enough. It's awesome that we do this. I enjoy doing the podcast, so thank you for your time and your expertise doing this show. We hope you guys as listeners have as much fun as we do creating it, because it is a lot of fun for us. So to you all, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. And until then, as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.
was Sinfonia in A Major by Sammartini. It's noted that the third vicar of Dunshire would play that every night before delivering sermons. It's a fine piece of music. It's 10 past the hour here on Vault Public Radio. We wanted to remind you, dear listener, that this week is Pledge Week at the Vault. Your support is vital, and giving to Vault Public Radio is one way to help support your community. And speaking of community, you won't find a better friendly community than the staff at Kelly's Westport Inn. Like public radio, Kelly's is a staple of the community, a standard, an icon, a Kansas City tradition. Fine patrons like yourself have been supporting Kelly's Westport Inn since 1947, when, I'd note, that Randall Kelly poured his first pint. Contribute to Vault Public Radio today, you can get an official VPR tote bag, or you could stop by Kelly's for an affordable pint, the best pizza in town, and a few games of Papa Shot. We're grateful for your support at VPR and for your support at Kelly's Westport Inn. Enjoy the tradition. And now, 4 hours of Best of the Baroque Period, followed by the Amstein Theaters and the Horse You Rode In On, hosted by Joseph Guevara Amherst.